Hi, I'm Richard Karn, and you may have seen me on TV talking about the world's number one expandable garden hose. Well, the brand new Pocket Hose Copperhead with Pocket Pivot is here, and it's a total game changer. Old-fashioned hoses get kinks and creases at the spigot, but the Copperhead's Pocket Pivot swivels 360 degrees for full water flow and freedom to water with ease all around your home. When you're all done, this rust-proof anti-burst hose shrinks back down to pocket size for effortless handling and tidy storage. Plus, your super light and ultra-durable pocket hose Copperhead is backed with a 10-year warranty. What could be better than that? I'll tell you what, an exciting exclusive offer just for you. For a limited time, you can get a free pocket pivot and their 10-pattern sprayer with the purchase of any size Copperhead hose. Just text WATER to 64000. That's WATER to 64000 for your two free gifts with purchase. W-A-T-E-R to 64000.
By texting 64000, you agree to receive recurring automated marketing messages from Pocket Hose. Message and data rates may apply. No purchase required. Terms apply. Available at pockethose.com/terms.
Some crimes are so heartbreaking or shocking that they change laws, change society, or even earn the label crime of the century. But the stories that made headlines in decades past aren't necessarily remembered today. I'm Amber Hunt, a journalist and author, and in each episode of this show, I'll examine a case that's maybe lesser known today, but was huge when it happened. This is Crimes of the Centuries. Early on September 19th, 1777, Benedict Arnold heard cannon fire in the near distance and rushed to round up his men to confront the British army bearing down on them. Accompanied by Colonel Daniel Morgan and his rough band of rifle-carrying mountain men, Arnold soon instructed Morgan's best snipers to aim at the men in the epaulets. That's right, he ordered them to kill the generals who were on horseback directing the enterprise. A lot of armies would have thought that wrong. Medieval code or something. This was not war, it was assassination. At the very least, it was ungentlemanly. I imagine he said, "Screw it. For the best part of my life, nobody thought of me as a gentleman. The cause I'm fighting for is not about how the privileged behave, it's about how to be free of that." This was not a dress rehearsal for amateurs. The fight for American independence had already claimed thousands of lives, but wasn't about backing down now and wasn't done with forcing one of the world's greatest powers to step aside. On the battlefield that day, deeply mired in the chaos that is war, both sides fought with incredible courage, sometimes hand to hand, sometimes with bayonets, sometimes with cannon and rifle fire. One colonial soldier recalled taking back the same little piece of land 9 times that day. Benedict Arnold had led those men all day and for most of the next few. Needed as well to do most of the thinking about how to deploy all the troops the Americans had on hand, he personified the cause. Loyal, brave, principled, fighting to the death. Arnold relentlessly made desperate forays into the field to survey conditions and shout orders, even as his expertise in strategy and his aggressive battlefield style rankled his superior officer, General Horatio Gates, sometimes known as Granny Gates, for his slow and indecisive battlefield manner. The battle, it would later be dubbed the First Battle of Saratoga, didn't end in a victory for either side. But the Americans had accomplished what no one thought was possible. For the first time since they had begun fighting the British for independence, they proved that they could meet the enemy head-on and hold their own. Historians, in retrospect, would call it a technical loss, but a strategic win. Men from both sides would single out Arnold's firm and audacious handling of men and munitions on that day, done so with a confidence and certainty that made the difference for those in battle and for the American colonists' cause. By the end of fighting that first day, 100 Americans were dead, 325 wounded. The British lost 160 men, and 364 were left grievously injured. The colonists slept with their rifles in the middle of the battleground, waiting for a second attack. It didn't come immediately, though every day was filled with skirmishes on the outskirts of the battlefield and in the forest beyond. The Americans were feeling mighty good about themselves. Then a small crack appeared in their collective armor. Gates, in reporting on the battle to the Continental Congress and to General George Washington, refrained from naming Arnold as a key contributor. He wrote, quote, "To discriminate in praise would be an injustice," end quote, despite the fact that these after-action accounts typically did cite those who were due credit and praise. Arnold's forces had done most of the heaviest lifting that day. He had done most of the leading. He deserved his due. Was jealousy at play? Ego? Arrogance? Short-sightedness? Hard to say. But Arnold was not happy when he learned of the missive and its contents from an adjutant. Now, let's try to understand Arnold's POV here. Here's Jack Kelly, author of God Save Benedict Arnold, The True Story of America's Most Hated Man.
General Horatio Gates was not a battle general. He was more of a staff officer, and he also had a very overblown view of his own abilities, and he spent a lot of time trying to figure out how to replace George Washington as head of the Continental Army. And then the man who would actually be facing the British in battle was Benedict Arnold.
So this celebrated guy who, by the way, was once likened to Caesar by John Adams, who truly put his life on the line, saw himself as sidelined by a guy who seemed more ego than action. Arnold had always been confrontational to begin with. In fact, it would be putting an awfully nice spin on it to simply call him virulently outspoken and deeply passionate. But now, Arnold's fervor bordered on outright insubordination. Things escalated into, quote-unquote, gross language and high words, with Arnold demanding to be allowed to leave to find a command in which he could be more, let's just say, appreciated. But Gates was a bit of a staunch SOB, and even facing another imminent British onslaught, told Arnold to just go. I'm going to assume everyone walked out of their proverbial huff and went back to their separate corners. But, as things do, tempers cooled. Arnold even decided to be generous, to take one for the team, writing Gates that he was willing to sacrifice his feelings for the cause. The two men were able to get along well enough to plan the battle's next phase, which was developing hourly. The second Battle of Saratoga occurred over several days in mid-October of 1777, but Arnold stood out as being everywhere all at once as reinforcements arrived to get new orders from him as he scouted out the enemy for future engagement. Later, it would be said, he made everyone brave. Until October 17, 1777, no American army had ever defeated a standing British army in battle. That changed that day. Estimated casualties, Americans, 330, British, 1,135. It was also the day that, in the midst of taking an enemy fortification, Arnold had his horse shot out from under him with an enemy musket ball slamming into his left leg, breaking his femur. It was the second time he had taken a direct hit in that leg. He was heard to say, quote, "I wish the ball had passed through my heart," end quote. Which kind of breaks mine, because, you know, that's pretty dark. But Arnold was a grim dude, kind of an all-or-nothing fellow. He saw the world as either perfect or completely ruined. He had, in fact, been one of the foremost reasons the Americans had won, and the British, running desperately low on food and this time clearly outmanned, were already in retreat northward, away from this hell. Historian and educator Jim Prococo explained,
"Without a doubt, Benedict Arnold was George Washington's best, bravest, and most ablest battlefield commander. Arnold was the American hero of the American victory at Saratoga."
The Second Battle of Saratoga likely changed the outcome of the Revolutionary War. It horrified the British public, angered the English king, and convinced the waffling French king to get behind the colonists, financially and otherwise. Here's Jack Kelly quoting Time magazine.
"The Battle of Saratoga was the single most important battle anywhere in the world in the last 1,000 years.
Today, at the Saratoga National Historic Site in upstate New York, an obelisk with a four-sided topper commemorates the battle. Each of the four sides serves as a shrine to one of the four men who carried the day. Each was meant to hold a sculpture of the man standing erect, viewing the battlefield. One side recognizes the undeserving Horatio Gates. On another is an important general named Philip Schuyler, you know his daughters if you've seen the much-celebrated Broadway musical Hamilton. The third gallant figure is the brave ruffian Colonel Daniel Morgan. The fourth is empty. That would be where the marble figure of Major General Benedict Arnold should stand, but doesn't. Because one of the greatest men who fought in the American Revolution would eventually go on to commit one of the most egregious crimes of the 18th century. He would go to the other side."
Hi, I'm Richard Karn, and you may have seen me on TV talking about the world's number one expandable garden hose. Well, the brand new Pocket Hose Copperhead with Pocket Pivot is here, and it's a total game changer. Old-fashioned hoses get kinks and creases at the spigot, but the Copperhead's Pocket Pivot swivels 360 degrees for full water flow and freedom to water with ease all around your home. When you're all done, this rust-proof anti-burst hose shrinks back down to pocket size for effortless handling and tidy storage. Plus, your super light and ultra-durable pocket hose Copperhead is backed with a 10-year warranty. What could be better than that? I'll tell you what, an exciting exclusive offer just for you. For a limited time, you can get a free pocket pivot and their 10-pattern sprayer with the purchase of any size Copperhead hose. Just text WATER to 64000. That's WATER to 64000 for your two free gifts with purchase. W-A-T-E-R to 64000.
By texting 64000, you agree to receive recurring automated marketing messages from Pocket Hose. Message and data rates may apply. No purchase required. Terms apply. Available at pockethose.com/terms.
This is a story about an American hero, one who literally saved the country before it was one, one who was nearly killed several times while leading its mostly unskilled, untested troops into danger and death. One who might have his own Broadway show today if he had not been such a freaking purist. Or a greedy ass. I'll get to that, but first, realize that this guy was literally destined to be on a quarter or a dime or some denomination of dollar bills someday. His story is so good, so brave, and so American that he maybe would have been commemorated with his own day. You know, the kind we get Mondays off for. But he is not remembered for his heroics. He is remembered for his treachery. And for something he had always had, sometimes to his own detriment, and something he was kind of a prig about. Honor. Okay, that sounds oxymoronic, but it isn't. Not if you thought like Benedict Arnold. He committed treason because many believe, and there is much proof and documentation to support it, that, to his eternal horror, he lost his faith that he was fighting for the good guys. Benedict Arnold was a fifth-generation, native-born son of Connecticut birth and of Puritan stock. His great-great-grandfather, also named Benedict, all of the firstborn men in the line were similarly christened, served as a governor of Rhode Island, which did not mean the Arnolds were wealthy planters or merchants or whatever else people did back then. The Benedict, whose name has entered the American vernacular, is synonymous with treasonous, traitor, turncoat, notorious chump, made his own way early on and did a bang-up job of it. He kind of had to. His father was an alcoholic who bankrupted the family. Jack Kelly again.
In childhood, one of his duties was to go out and collect his father laying in the street or, you know, passed out in some tavern there.
Those memories would forever be seared into Benedict's psyche.
These experiences of seeing his father helplessly drunk sort of pushed him towards this constant wanting to more and more success.
While still a boy, Benedict dropped out of school and got an apprenticeship as an apothecary. 7 years later, and done with his indentured servitude and having gotten the hang of the apothecary biz, Arnold went to sea and was running his own ships in short order. By 34, he was well on his way to being an incredibly prosperous trader. That's with a D, not a T. Doing international business. He also owned a retail store operating a Swift business in New Haven, Connecticut, and also owned wharves on the waterfront there where the trading vessels he also owned shipped out of. It's been said he also smuggled rum and molasses with those boats, but all's fair in love and contraband. And it was lucrative, nice setup for his wife Margaret and their three small sons. In Jack Kelly's 2023 biography of Arnold, he writes, quote, "Yet Arnold could smell the future. Something fundamental was about to happen. He had always felt an irresistible urge, almost a mania, to climb, to acquire, to become somebody. Here was an opportunity even grander, a chance to play a role in history, a chance for immortality. He never hesitated." End quote. I have no fear. I'm not going to reteach you the American Revolution here, as I assume you paid some attention in school. What they told you, Boston Tea Party, Boston Massacre, Greedy Brits, no taxation without representation, all that stuff generally holds. But I'm not so sure the American side was as clean and organized and egalitarian as we are all led to believe. I won't beat around the bush here. People were in charge of things, and you know how people are. They're the worst. They have egos and quirks and needs and wants and ambition and frailty. They have competing desires. They have pride. They have personal notions of who they are and how they want to be remembered. They're, you know, human beings. Sure, the Revolution was full of the whizziest of whiz kids and Thomas Jefferson and John Adams and Benjamin Franklin and Alexander Hamilton, but it was still a bunch of guys, all male, all white, who had a few disagreements about how things ought to go, who ought to be in charge, and who ought to get the credit. For starters, you had the Constitutional Congress, who believed that civil control of the army was the way to go. George Washington was a proponent of that approach as well, wanting civilians to have control over their own government. But he also thought that those who did the dying ought to have more say in who literally led them into battle. Prococo again.
George Washington often found himself at odds with the Continental Congress over the system of promotions of his fellow officers. He was hamstrung by Congress because Congress controlled not only the purse strings of the war effort, but also controlled who would be promoted and who would not be promoted.
Maybe they were pushing that civilian rule thing a little too far. And like I said, these civilians and the military men alike had their own agendas, complete with jealousies. Who was getting ahead? How can we submarine them? How can we advance our own positions, our own regard, our own legacies? Do I sound like I'm talking about teenage girls wrangling for prom queen? Yeah, it was like that. Nobody was playing nice. The officers wrote letters to Congress and Washington and anyone else in power to undermine their peers. And that sometimes meant that some officers, Arnold and Morgan were in that crowd, had to defend themselves in court, had to answer slanderous and libelous claims and were passed over for promotion, even if they were, you know, winning the war out there. The civilian response was to promote some men, ignore others. And this deceitful crap is precisely where Benedict Arnold's story began its odd descent from hero to the most criminaliest of criminals. Now, I'm not joking. There aren't a lot of other criminals whose name is now shorthand for evil. You Benedict Arnold, someone yells at the double-dealing swine they're dealing with while playing games or running for president. But back to Benedict, he believed deeply that a man should be judged not by his birth, but by his achievements. He did not believe that power should accrue to those because they were, for instance, royal or well-born or the cousin of the biggest landholder. I'm on that bus. But he took it to extremes, always did. He was just that kind of guy. Probably made him as annoying as shit, but that was his flaw and his credo for living. While in Honduras in 1770, during one of his Caribbean trading journeys, he challenged a British sea captain to a duel because the fellow had the audacity to call him a damned Yankee destitute of good manners. Gad, not that. Anyway, they squared off per duel etiquette, and the British guy got winged. Arnold was ready to go again, but the British guy said he was sorry, and everybody went their separate ways. It was not Arnold's first duel, nor his last. He sailed home only to find that his new money was welcome, but he and his wife still weren't getting invitations to the right parties because, you know, they had not been well born. That didn't sit well. Then along came the Stamp Act, Britain's way of taxing without asking. And it was an arbitrary show of power that hit the new wharf mogul in his pocketbook. This, ladies and gentlemen, was something to fight over.
Hi, I'm Richard Karn, and you may have seen me on TV talking about the world's number one expandable garden hose. Well, the brand new Pocket Hose Copperhead with Pocket Pivot is here, and it's a total game changer. Old-fashioned hoses get kinks and creases at the spigot, but the Copperhead's Pocket Pivot swivels 360 degrees for full water flow and freedom to water with ease all around your home. When you're all done, this rust-proof anti-burst hose shrinks back down to pocket size for effortless handling and tidy storage. Plus, your super light and ultra-durable pocket hose Copperhead is backed with a 10-year warranty. What could be better than that? I'll tell you what, an exciting exclusive offer just for you. For a limited time, you can get a free pocket pivot and their 10-pattern sprayer with the purchase of any size Copperhead hose. Just text WATER to 64000. That's WATER to 64000 for your two free gifts with purchase. W-A-T-E-R to 64000.
By texting 64000, you agree to receive recurring automated marketing messages from Pocket Hosts. Message and data rates may apply. No purchase required. Terms apply. Available at pockethosts.com/terms.
Sally from finance loves fly fishing. She used to spend her weekend surrounded by receipts. Then she switched her company to Ramp. Now, spend is all under control, all in one place. Her team submits their expenses with a text, and she can close the books without all the busy work. So Sally's weekends are all her own, surrounded by fish, not receipts. Switch your business to ramp.com and love finance again.
When shots were fired in Lexington and Concord on April 9th, 1775, Arnold gathered up some pals and made them into the Connecticut Militia Company. He served as their first captain. They were all of the same mind, all signing a pledge that they would conduct themselves decently and inoffensively in this ordeal. Yeah, that one baffled me. We're talking about people who are going to kill other people to make their point about liberty. I'm not sure how offensive that is to the person being killed, but I'm guessing at least a little. Anyway, when they all got to Boston to defend the honor of the colonies, Arnold noticed that nobody on his side of the fracas was all that well equipped to do that. He then remembered that there was this British fort that was once well stocked during the French and Indian War and was now sparsely defended. He thought it'd be a good idea to go there and get what they left behind. General Washington thought that was brilliant and gave him the commission to bring back the cannons and such that they found there. The fort was named Ticonderoga and sits now, as it did then, at the confluence of Lake George and Lake Champlain, meaning that it controlled the access north and south between Albany and Montreal. But Ethan Allen had the same idea. Allen was a big deal farmer and one of the founders of Vermont, and quite possibly also a traitor as he tried to make a separate deal with the British later in the war. But early on, he fought with the colonists. He and his little bunch of revolutionaries called themselves the Green Mountain Boys, and they were not the civilized crew that Arnold's company was. I'm not necessarily judging anyone here, just stating the facts. I mean, it is war, and war is, by definition, uncivilized behavior. So Allen and Arnold agreed to split the cannon job, staging a successful sneak attack on the almost unguarded fort on the night of May 10th, 1775. The Green Mountain Boys and Arnold's militia thus get credited with winning the first American victory in the war. But the Green Mountain Boys behaved like hooligans. They even shot at Arnold, who was trying to get them to stop pillaging the fort. It didn't end well between Allen and Arnold, but Arnold helped bring back some 59 cannons, hauling them across rough terrain to shore up Boston. Arnold then made the case that Lake Champlain, situated as it is between Canada and New York, was the key to controlling a lot of the access the British then had to American cities. He was told to go ahead, travel north with some troops, and capture the walled enclave of Quebec City. Arnold and his troops struggled, sometimes alone in the wilderness, sometimes starving, sometimes freezing, but he held everyone together. Congress made things appreciably worse when they refused to support him with reinforcements or provisions. Arnold's men were down to eating candles and soap. So Arnold left his troops to forage for food, returning later with a herd of cattle. When they got to Quebec City, they attacked it and outlasted a British general there all through a terrible Canadian winter. But reinforcements came for the British, and Arnold was then forced to retreat back through Montreal, all while torching everything in sight. It was hell, but his men loved him, and he loved them. Sometimes finding housing for those badly injured, even paying settlers out of his own pocket to nurture his wounded, sometimes for months. Thus ended the American attempt to take Canada. Meanwhile, in the summer of 1776, the British decided to ramp up their own troops, sending almost 50,000 of their and Haitian soldiers to set up camp on Staten Island. The Americans were getting squeezed. On July 4th, 1776, the Declaration of Independence was signed, and those highest of ideals for a perfect democracy were writ large upon the landscape. I'm going to assume this was a pretty important moment for Arnold, who, you know, loved high ideals and craved perfection and thought democracy was damn near heaven. However, you should know that Arnold's enemies within have been all the while sending all kinds of nasty reports back to both Philadelphia, where the Congress met, and New York, where Washington was based. The reports indicated that Arnold had profited from the war and disobeyed countless orders. Washington wasn't buying that crap. Most of the accusations were met with acquittals, except for the charge that he had used congressional money to maintain his own lifestyle. Arnold countered that he paid those who served with him on the water out of his own pocket when Congress didn't have the means to do so. It became a mortal battle over accounting. Congress eventually announced that he was, in fact, in debt to the Congress to the tune of $1,000. Arnold stood fast. He had spent a lot of time and his own money, risked his life and his businesses in New Haven, left his sons, his wife had died in 1775 while he was away, with his sister for this cause that wasn't remotely appreciated if you didn't count the people who lived in this newly declared country. They loved him, throwing accolades upon him anytime they chanced to see him. He fretted, yet he was put to work again. This time by General Gates, who decided to have Arnold build a fleet to safeguard the lake. He named Arnold commander of that fleet.
General Gates was a genius of organization. He knew how to rebuild the army, restore morale, restore discipline, rebuild the fortifications around Fort Ticonderoga. And Benedict Arnold turned out to be a genius of war itself. He was very astute at tactics and strategy. And as a bonus, he had been a sea captain before the war.
The gunboats he built with men who had never built boats and never been to sea were not pretty, but they did float. They would be going against the greatest navy in the world, which had troubled itself to build the mighty HMS Inflexible, a 280-ton sloop of war with massive guns staffed with a trained crew of British sailors. In a remarkable battle on the lake in October 1776, Arnold's little flotilla went against larger British ships and various gunboats. The battle lasted 6 to 7 hours, with the Americans getting the worst of it. That night, the remaining American boats quietly sailed past the sleeping British and hid themselves behind Valcour Island, a spit of land that sat in the middle of the lake. When the British were ready to resume the battle in the morning, the enemy was nowhere in sight. Arnold's plan was simple. The British would not see his boats until they were past him. Knowing they can't easily turn the large ships, especially against the wind, the little band of Americans would be able to get a drop on the larger boats, attacking them from the rear. It worked, if only for a while. Outmatched, outgunned, and outsailored, the American boats were eventually overwhelmed by the superior force. Arnold stayed on the boat nearest the fight when he ordered all of the rest of his gunboats to be driven into land, set aflame, and told his sailors to run like hell back to Fort Ticonderoga. It was only 35 miles away. Even the British papers would take note of his bravery when they wrote of the battle. In some ways, this October 1776 battle allowed Washington to take his larger army to Valley Forge intact, to spend the winter, to ford the Delaware River, and go on to his victory at the Battle of Trenton. As I said before, promoting officers had, for 2 years, been rather an arbitrary process. The Continental Congress seemed to think it needed to reform its methodology in doing so. They decided that, quote, "In voting for general officers, a due regard shall be had to the line of succession, the merit of the person proposed, and the quota of troops raised, and to be raised by each state," end quote. That February, 5 men were promoted above Arnold, including men who had served under him in battle. He wrote Washington that he viewed that as, quote, "a very civil way of requesting my resignation," end quote. Washington wouldn't accept his resignation, instead writing Congress to ask them to fix this mistake and please do it quick. The father of our country then added, quote, "I'm anxious to know if General Arnold's non-promotion was due to accident or design," end quote. The Congress replied it was no accident. Each state, they explained, were allotted a certain number of generals to represent them. Connecticut had already reached its quota. Arnold, ever mindful of slights, ever sure that others were conspiring against him, likened it to the British system they were all supposed to be rebelling against. But then, and I know this is skipping a lot of American history here, his home state came under attack and he rallied as many militiamen as he could find, and wasn't as many as he had hoped, to defend the town of Ridgefield. Standing again at the front of the line in what appeared to be hand-to-hand combat, his horse was shot out from under him, landing on him as he took that first musket ball to his leg. When an enemy soldier approached him to take him prisoner, Arnold reached out from under the horse and shot the soldier dead. John Adams would later say, quote, "I wish we could strike a medal showing a platoon firing at General Arnold on horseback, his horse falling dead under him before his retreat," end quote. Hobbling a bit after the wound in April, Arnold was named military commander of Philadelphia, a town which the British had just vacated. This may have been George Washington's largest mistake of the war. A month later, in early May 1777, Brigadier General Arnold was made a major general, and he found himself living in a large mansion, being wined and dined by the city of brotherly love's finest. He became smitten with a reigning belle of Philadelphia, 18-year-old Peggy Shippen, the daughter of moderate loyalists. It was deemed okay for Arnold to mingle with the loyalists there, as while they weren't keen on the Declaration of Independence, they stopped short of aiding and abetting the British. So Arnold did. Mingle, that is, to get close to Peggy and to those who still ruled the city. It also put him in close proximity to the Continental Congress, his enduring nemesis. In short order, he considered resigning his commission again. And in an October 1890 issue of The Atlantic, writer John Fiske explained that Philadelphia was particularly hard to govern, as the state government and the military leaders were always at odds. And much of the work they did that angered the populace fell back on Arnold. Fiske wrote, quote, "It was charged against Arnold that the extravagance of his style of living was an offense against Republican simplicity, and a scandal in view of the distressed condition of the country, that in order to obtain the means of meeting his heavy expenses, he resorted to peculation and extortion, and that he showed too much favor to the Tories," end quote. He added that these charges were doubtless not without some foundation. Peggy had been a belle before Arnold got there, being wooed by several British officers. That included British Major John Andre, who, cue the foreshadowing vibe, had since been made head of espionage for the British in New York.
With a $5 meal deal with new McValue. You pick a McDouble or a McChicken, then get a small fry, a small drink, and a four-piece McNuggets. That's a lot of McDonald's for not a lot of money.
Prices and participation may vary. McDouble meal $6 in some markets for a limited time only.
Hi, I'm Richard Karn, and you may have seen me on TV talking about the world's number one expandable garden hose. Well, the brand new Pocket Hose Copperhead with Pocket Pivot is here, and it's a total game changer. Old-fashioned hoses get kinks and creases at the spigot, but the Copperhead's Pocket Pivot swivels 360 degrees for full water flow and freedom to water with ease all around your home. When you're all done, this rust-proof anti-burst hose shrinks back down to pocket size for effortless handling and tidy storage. Plus, your super light and ultra-durable pocket hose Copperhead is backed with a 10-year warranty. What could be better than that? I'll tell you what, an exciting exclusive offer just for you. For a limited time, you can get a free pocket pivot and their 10-pattern sprayer with the purchase of any size Copperhead hose. Just text WATER to 64000. That's WATER to 64000 for your two free gifts with purchase. W-A-T-E-R to 64000.
By texting 64000, you agree to receive recurring automated marketing messages from Pocket Host. Message and data rates may apply. No purchase required. Terms apply. Available at pockethost.com/terms.
As Benedict Arnold's courtship of the young Peggy Shippen continued, so too did her correspondence with British Major John Andre. Arnold had Shippen's loyalist family whispering in his ear, and also this Andre, his love's family friend who so happened to be a British spy. What could go wrong? Meanwhile, Arnold was settling into Philadelphia, trying to transition it back to civilian rule.
And he got to know all the families in Philadelphia, particularly the loyalist-leaning families, because they were the rich people, and he was a rich man himself.
Arnold was quite enjoying the opulent lifestyle that he saw there, enjoying the wealth his position afforded, being slowly convinced that the British may have had the right idea after all. However, life free from the battlefield did not altogether suit Arnold, and Washington announced a wartime assignment for him. That summer of 1777, British General Burgoyne was in Canada and ready to work his way south to Albany to, in effect, divide the colonies in half. Arnold was sent to the Continental Army's Northern Department, where he heard that a white woman named Jane McCrae had been scalped and raped after being taken captive by the natives who had joined forces with the British. He told General Schuyler he would go and see what was up. He took 800 soldiers with him. The Redcoats had twice that. But he had an idea. A Tory militiaman who had offended someone higher up had been ordered to die. His family asked if Arnold could help him. Arnold agreed to save the man if he would go back to the fort to explain to both the British and the Oneida Nation members who were fighting with them that Arnold had more men and more artillery than they. The Tory in question was married to an Oneida woman, so he was trusted by both. The Tory must have done some talking. The Oneida backing the British left. The small British force then decided it too wasn't up for the fight. In the day that followed, only 12 were killed and 23 wounded. Arnold looked like a genius. Next came the fall of 1777 and the Battle of Saratoga, parts 1 and 2, when the Americans scored that decisive victory because of Arnold's bravery and skill, though the commanding officer didn't single him out for recognition. This is the battle in which Arnold was shot a second time in the leg, ultimately requiring him to be carried off the field and forced to spend an extended time in recuperation. During the hero's painful recovery in 1779, he married Peggy Shippen. Sometime in between Philadelphia and marrying Miss Shippen, Arnold decided to write his new wife's friend, the British spy, about changing his loyalties. They wrote in code. Yeah, that's not a good sign. In July 1780, Arnold asked Washington if he could be put in charge of West Point. George Washington, hearing that Arnold was anxious to get back into the fight, instead gave him a prestigious battle command in his own army.
Peggy Arnold is informed that Benedict will not be receiving West Point, but will be going back out in the field, and this happens at a dinner. She is shocked and stunned because that's not how the plan was supposed to go.
That's Charlene Boyer Lewis of Kalamazoo College, a historian who believes that Peggy was indeed an important reason why Arnold switched alliances and was involved in the plot to hand over West Point to the British. As luck would have it, that battlefield post fell through, and Washington agreed to Arnold's request instead by handing him the command of the New York fort on the Hudson River that even Washington believed was, quote, the most important post in America, end quote. On September 21st, 1780, Arnold handed over blueprints of the fort as well as other important data about the location and strength of the American army to Andre. He would make it easy for the British to take over the fort. Andre promised £20,000 and a lofty British military command. On his way back to deliver to British commanders the papers Arnold had given him, Andre was captured by three American militiamen who just happened upon him. They found what he was hiding and took him prisoner. Meanwhile, George Washington was on his way to West Point to make a routine inspection. This leads many to assume that the plan to take the fort included the capture and execution of Washington. Prococo again.
When Washington gets to West Point, he realizes something is amiss. The guards aren't posted. The fortifications are a wreck. He's absolutely mystified as to what's going on. The papers are then presented to him.
These are the papers that documented Arnold's treachery. He was heard to mutter, "Who now can we trust?" Then he authorized officers to kidnap Arnold or kill him on sight. No one spoke of Saratoga. Wrote the historian Gardner Allen in 1913, quote, "It thus came about, through a singular instance of the irony of fate, that we owe the salvation of our country at a critical point to one of the blackest traitors in history," end quote. Arnold fled, first to New York and then to London, and Major Andre was summarily executed. Benjamin Franklin would write in a letter to the Marquis de Lafayette, quote, "Judas sold only one man, Arnold, 3 million. Ultimately, Peggy was deemed not culpable in his crime, but was forced to leave the country to go to England, where her husband now lived. His subsequent businesses there were not successful. It's even said the British soldiers who had fought against him detested him for his actions. He died in 1801 at age 60. A Massachusetts paper writing on his demise said he was notorious throughout the world. It was later reported that his last words were, quote, "Let me die in this old uniform in which I fought my battles. May God forgive me for ever having put on another," end quote. Did he actually say that? Some would like to think so, I guess, since we love the guilty to say they were wrong. Is it true? I'm not so sure. There's an ongoing debate among historians about whether, if he had succeeded in turning over West Point to the British, the war would have gone differently. You know, that the colonists would have been done for pretty quick. Others say the fort wasn't that important, given that the English had bigger fish to fry and didn't have the resources or the desire to continue the fight much longer. Today, at one of the smaller chapels at West Point, which is now one of the nation's premier military academies, there is a wall that's filled with plaques naming the great men of the Revolution. On one bronze plaque, only the words Major General appear. Under it, born 1741. To research this case, journalist Amy Wilson read Jack Kelly's God Save Benedict Arnold, The True Story of the Most Hated Man in America. She also spent a lot of time with American history websites, YouTube videos, and a random college textbook she found in the attic. She watched a really slanted documentary about Arnold, which you won't name here because she doesn't like conflict. Crimes of the Centuries is available early and ad-free through GrabBagCollab. Join us at patreon.com/grabbagcollab to hear not just exclusive content related to this show, but to also get access to several other shows on our profit-sharing network. Unless noted in the citations, this case was researched and written by me, Amber Hunt, and produced by Amanda Rassman and Henry Lavoie. Original music is by Bruce Hunt, Andrew Higley, and occasionally by my son, Hunt Van Benskoten. Other music comes from Soundstripe and Epidemic Sound. If you like the show, help us out by rating and reviewing us on Apple Podcasts. For more information or to recommend a case, go to centuriespod.com. On Instagram, we're at centuriespod, and check out our Crimes of the Centuries podcast Facebook page.
Hi, I'm Richard Karn, and you may have seen me on TV talking about the world's number one expandable garden hose. Well, the brand new Pocket Hose Copperhead with Pocket Pivot is here, and it's a total game changer. Old-fashioned hoses get kinks and creases at the spigot, but the Copperhead's Pocket Pivot swivels 360 degrees for full water flow and freedom to water with ease all around your home. When you're all done, this rust-proof anti-burst hose shrinks back down to pocket size for effortless handling and tidy storage. Plus, your super light and ultra-durable pocket hose Copperhead is backed with a 10-year warranty. What could be better than that? I'll tell you what, an exciting exclusive offer just for you. For a limited time, you can get a free Pocket Pivot and their 10-pattern sprayer with the purchase of any size Copperhead hose. Just text WATER to 64000. That's WATER to 64000 for your two free gifts with purchase. W-A-T-E-R to 64000.
By texting 64000, you agree to receive recurring automated marketing messages from Pocket Hose. Message and data rates may apply. No purchase required. Terms apply. Available at pockethose.com/terms.
You've done it again, finance teams. You closed the books, and it went fine. Sure, some expenses were missing receipts, but that's fine. Stayed late to process invoices by hand. It's all fine. But don't you deserve better than fine? With Ramp, expenses are submitted with a text, invoices are coded automatically, and everything is connected to your accounting system so you can close the books without all the busy work. Switch your business to ramp.com and love finance again.
Hi, I'm Richard Karn, and you may have seen me on TV talking about the world's number one expandable garden hose. Well, the brand new Pocket Hose Copperhead with Pocket Pivot is here, and it's a total game changer. Old-fashioned hoses get kinks and creases at the spigot, but the Copperhead's Pocket Pivot swivels 360 degrees for full water flow and freedom to water with ease all around your home. When you're all done, this rust-proof anti-burst hose shrinks back down to pocket size for effortless handling and tidy storage. Plus, your super light and ultra-durable pocket hose Copperhead is backed with a 10-year warranty. What could be better than that? I'll tell you what, an exciting exclusive offer just for you. For a limited time, you can get a free Pocket Pivot and their 10-pattern sprayer with the purchase of any size Copperhead hose. Just text WATER to 64000. That's WATER to 64000 for your two free gifts with purchase. W-A-T-E-R to 64000.
By texting 64000, you agree to receive recurring automated marketing messages from Pocket Hose. Message and data rates may apply. No purchase required. Terms apply. Available at pockethose.com/terms.